Ladies and gentlemen, the sound you hear is a buzzsaw ripping through a painting of George Washington chopping down cherry trees. It's time for Professor Buzzkill, busting myths and taking names.
Brr, Buzzkillers, it's cold outside here in the Northern Hemisphere. Our Australian and New Zealand Buzzkillers won't be sympathetic to us, but we're freezing our buzz-killing behinds off here. Professor Nass is with us. How are you, Professor?
I'm doing great, thanks.
It's a perfect day to talk about FDR's fireside chats. You know those fireside chats, Buzzkillers, where the president went on and told everyone about the state of the nation. Is that what happened, Professor?
Yeah, kind of.
Why were they fireside chats? Where did that come from?
I think it's because people would sit by their fireside where normally their radio was located.
Oh, okay.
And listen to the president. Oh, and also, I think it's also more broadly sort of the connotation that you're sort of, there's like this home-like atmosphere.
Warm in which, feeling glow.
Right, exactly. In which you sort of establish this more personal bond with the president of the United States.
Yes, I think one of the things we forget is that so many people sat around the radio. They didn't have the radio on when they were doing dishes or whatever. I mean, they had it on doing dishes, but to actually sit down and watch it, listen to it while like we watch TV is an amazing thing.
Right. And also keep in mind that in this day and age, the radio is, it's not just this tiny little thing that you can carry around with you. It's more like a piece of furniture or a major appliance. They were large. They had this big wooden frame and sort of box around them.
Yeah.
And it was something you plugged into the wall and kept in a permanent place somewhere in your house.
And so by the fire.
By the fire, where people could gather around, absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay. No. And so, I mean, let's talk a little bit about the I don't think it's an exaggeration to talk about the radio revolution.
Yeah.
Because it really did change people's lives, and very, very quickly. It was we're used to this in our time, but.
Except that most people listen to the radio only in the car now, but that's a separate
right. Or they listen to podcasts.
Oh yes, that's right. Yes, trash the radio, Buzzkillers. Subscribe to Buzz to
right. The podcast. But also keep in mind that we go from a situation where there's no radio at all to mm-hmm. a situation where radio becomes. In other words, it's a very rapid adoption of a form of technology of the type that we're sort of used to in terms of the pace. But around 1920. The United States radios really didn't exist.
Uh-huh.
In fact, 1920 is the key year. That's when KDKA in Pittsburgh.
Oh yes,
actually broadcasts the election results from the presidential election of 1920,
and that's the first.
That's basically the first radio broadcast.
First
in the
national
States.
Radio broadcast.
Yes, okay. I believe so.
Okay. Okay.
Although, of course, there were so few radios out there, very few people heard it. Sort of like the first television broadcasts were. Huh. TVs existed, but very few people saw them.
Huh.
In any case, by 1929, 40% of U.S. households have a radio.
Within a decade.
And then if you fast forward to the end of Roosevelt's term, 1945, 90% of Americans have a radio.
At home.
A bunch of, I forget the exact number, but a huge percentage of those have more than one radio in the home.
Oh.
And a quarter of radio owners have one in their car.
Oh, that must have been an innovation.
I'm sure that was like the second coming when people could actually listen to the radio while they were driving around. Keep in mind, of course, that more Americans have cars and spend more time in their cars. But in other words, we go from a situation where radio is not a thing to almost instantly it has transformed people's lives. People like with television later.
Right. Well, how about fireplaces? How many people have firesides that they can sit next to listen to the chats?
That I don't know. Although, of course, a lot of small and large homes back then did have fireplaces, and it was in the living room, which was the one area where people could gather around. There is this soon-to-be-famous Groucho Marx quotation.
Promoted by yours truly.
Exactly, and I appreciate that. Apparently in the movie Room Service, 1935, Groucho Marx says, and I'm quoting, "You have no fireplace? How do you listen to the president's speeches?"
The implication being, of course, you have to sit down exactly, by the fireside in order to listen to the fireside
exactly.
chats, which
is nuts. Right, like the fireplace and the radio come together as a set.
Yeah, in the Sears catalog.
In the Sears catalog. Obviously, then by the way, that reference in that movie at that time, 1935, gives you some idea of what we're talking about here, which is these fireside chats, which become so important and so famous.
Right. Within 2 years.
Because within 2 years.
Inaugurated in 1933. Right. Okay. FDR, that is. Groucho Marx was never inaugurated.
But as president, was he president when he was Rufus D. Firefly?
That's a good question. I thought he was diplomat or something.
I forget.
So that brings me to this interesting sort of cliche in history, this known phrase that everybody knows, fireside chats. We even have something now called Fireside Chat Winter Spiced Ale from the 21st Amendment Brewery Probably Company. 20,
and I've had it, even though it comes in cans, not bottles.
Oh.
Drinker beware, it comes in cans, not bottles, but it is tasty. It's 21st Amendment Brewery, Fireside Chat. It has a drawing on the cover of FDR sitting by his fireside with his cigarette and cigarette holder and a fancy beer glass. And I'm thinking he was not a beer drinker, but it's winter spiced ale. It's extremely tasty.
I wish we could give it away to any buzzkillers who call in asking for it, but I don't think legally you can do that in these United States.
First five callers.
But why, for instance, we should tell the buzzkillers why it's called 21st Amendment Brewery.
Right.
By the way, this is a free ad, 21st Amendment Brewery. Hint, hint, hint.
Exactly. Yes. Would you help us out? I'll get to this more in a minute, but one of the few bright signs in early 1933 was the adoption of the 21st Amendment of the Constitution, which is the only one that overturns an earlier amendment to the Constitution.
The first time? Oh,
yep,
okay.
First and last, as far as I know. The 18th Amendment established national prohibition. The 21st Amendment overturned it, did away with it, and so people could drink legally. It was phased in over time, et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, and so, in fact, there's a pub in Washington, D.C., unrelated to the brewery. I assume it's still there, called the 21st Amendment.
Oh, there you go. Yeah. Okay. So people could sit down by their fireside and get hammered while listening to
it. But there's another important part of the context here alongside the radio revolution, which is people should know that before Franklin Roosevelt, people had, compared even to today, a very sort of distant relationship with the president and the presidency.
Okay.
And also the United States government, the federal government in general, had a very minimal role in people's lives. Government was small in today's definition. You could go your entire life. In fact, most Americans did. You go your entire life, and the sum total of your connection with the federal government was the mailman.
Oh, no kidding. Taxes and the mailman.
Taxes and the mailman. Yeah, and keep in mind that federal taxes were relatively small as well. You didn't have all these other – you didn't have Social Security. You didn't have federal deposit insurance. You didn't have a regulated stock market. That's going to be a problem, as we'll see in a minute. In other words, the president – you might occasionally see a soldier or a sailor on the street. But on a day-to-day basis, the federal government just really doesn't exist for you.
Okay.
And the president is not really a presence in your life on a daily basis.
So do you only read about him in newspapers?
You read about him in the newspaper, or public experience would be more regional. In other words, like the president comes into town and gives a speech and you go and see him. But, you know, the president is this distant figure. You probably never hear his voice, for example.
Yes, of course, because even in movie newsreels, it would be
silent until the late 20s. So it's, you know, today, if you want to keep in touch with politics or the president, you have all these outlets, right? You can C-SPAN and the internet. And
in fact, lots of my friends have gone on a news famine because of what they think is bad news this year. And they're telling me.
A news diet.
News diet. They're telling me it's actually hard to do. It's actually
hard to unplug. Absolutely.
Yeah.
I find that myself. Yeah, if you're interested in politics. Very difficult to go cold turkey.
Yeah. So what you've got a situation is where you would know what the president looks like because you see his picture in the newspaper. You may see him in newsreels and at the movie theater and on and on and on. But most people don't know what he sounds like.
Right. You know, and you might feel some attachment to that leader. I mean, for example, I'm always surprised by if you look at when Warren G. Harding dies in 1923, there is actually a national outpouring of grief.
Wow.
And my reaction was, really, for Warren G. Harding?
Yeah. Well,
but you know, and I think so people do feel this connection, but it's not nearly as intimate as what you're going to see later. It's not nearly as sort of based on sort of personal knowledge or personal contact the way that's going to come with technology.
Okay. So technology really is a biggie.
Right.
But of course, you just mentioned with an unregulated stock market and other things, we've been hinting at the Great Depression is coming. Great Depression comes and that helps bring –
absolutely.
FDR into power, but give the buzzkiller some background about that.
Right. Well, I would stress this with my students, it's not fundamentally about the stock market crash. The stock market crash of October 1929 is more of a what we would call a trigger event.
Right.
The underlying causes, maybe we can do a separate show on this, the underlying causes are much more complicated. But in any case, the economy tanks beginning in late 1929. And for our purposes here, it's really important because people's need for the connection, people's need for inspirational leadership goes way, way up.
Oh, right.
And they really don't find it. I don't think it's unfair to say. They really don't find it with the incumbent in the White House, Herbert Hoover, who...
Yes. Maybe not as bad as Silent Cal, but certainly not.
Right. Silent Cal weaned on a pickle.
Yeah, that's Coolidge Buskillers.
Yes, that's his predecessor. And who, by the way, everyone expected to run again in 1928 and then declined. And it was a very shrewd move. You know, because and
I'm
Hoover,
out.
I mean, exactly, I'm out. Yeah. What did he know that the rest of us didn't know? It's personally, and I'm not a huge Hoover fan, but it is a personally sad story because when Herbert Hoover is elected in 1928, he is one of the most popular politicians in his era.
Oh yeah,
widely admired. He was a self-made millionaire, huge success. One of the, it's not a really prestige post, but easily the most successful Secretary of Commerce in the history of the United States. Made a huge impact. There's a book about him called Herbert Hoover, Forgotten Progressive, because he really was sort of in the progressive wing of the Republican Party at the time, often overlooked. So, yeah, so and then he's inaugurated in March 1929 and has about 6 good months as president. And then we are submerged in by far the worst economic calamity in American history. Even those of us who lived through this recent so-called Great Recession, it was – I'm not taking anything away from the people who suffered in that and are suffering because of that, but
this is a 2008.
This is 2008, yeah. Right after 2008. The Great Depression really is in its own category. If you look at all the indicators, if you look at how long it lasted, you had an entire generation of people who grew up not only knowing Franklin Roosevelt as president, only knowing Great Depression as the natural order of things economically.
Sure.
It lasted essentially 12 years.
Yeah. If you're 7 or 8 years old and you lived through the Great Depression, you've grown up with that. That's your only
frame of reference.
Yeah.
And it's only World War II and the epic deficit spending caused by World War II that lifts us out of the Great Depression.
Right. And you can imagine if you're born in 1928, you as a child, you're in the Great Depression, and then all of a sudden there's the war.
All you've known
is depression and war.
For millions of young people, all you know is privation.
Yeah. Yeah.
And by the way, I'm sure a lot of buzzkillers, either in the United States or in Western Europe, certainly where depression was most dire, can either remember or go talk to their older relatives and find evidence of how people's behavior was just fundamentally transformed for all time by some of these experiences.
And the reason we're talking about this at length, Buzzkillers, is because of what Professor Nash said earlier, which is this sort of reconnection, this personal feeling that people supposedly got from the fireside chats. But I remember my grandparents talking and being sort of more highly budget conscious than anyone I knew because, of course, they had to make do and mend in the 30s.
Right, and then subsequent generations like ours are left puzzling, like, why are they so – for example, why do they insist that we finish everything on our plate when we're already full? Or why are they saving – why do they have a huge ball of string that they keep adding to?
Yeah.
Right, and why do they reuse everything?
Why did they only have one car and $20,000 in the bank?
Because they were worried about. Or even today, you can find old people die and then they find all sorts of money stashed away in odd places in their house. That's depression era mentality.
Yeah.
Right? That should be earning interest. It shouldn't be in the mattress.
Well, that's right. Yeah, right. But if the banks fail, if you have personal experience of banks failing, then you stuff
that
money under your bed. Yeah.
And so that leads us to this period called – the historians have actually referred to it as the Interregnum of Despair, which I think is a hilarious, hilariously academic title. Keep in mind that there was always in this period, a four-month gap between a presidential election and the new president's inauguration.
Right. They're inaugurated in March.
In March. Then, on March 4th.
January.
Correct.
Yeah.
That's fixed only at the beginning of FDR's second term. Mm-hmm. So there's this period where the economy is entering its worst phase. Hoover is a lame duck, so he's not going to do anything new. And he, of course, one of his big problems was he had been sort of hampered by his philosophy, which was a fundamentally small government philosophy.
Right.
He was terrified that if the government got involved directly in providing relief, that you'd create a generation of dependent Americans, right? Mm-hmm. He worries about people living on the dole. Roosevelt doesn't want to do anything to cooperate with the lame duck president, because then if it doesn't work out, Roosevelt will get blamed for it, right? He wants to only act when he's president. And so you essentially have no leadership as the economy tanks. It's in early 1933, before Roosevelt is inaugurated, that unemployment peaks at 25%.
Wow.
Which is just a breathtaking figure, a figure I still can't really get my head around, 25% unemployment. And by the way, much worse in individual pockets of the country.
Regional.
Right. I think Cleveland, Ohio, for example, had 50% unemployment.
Oh, my goodness me.
And there were some cases even worse. Right. If you're heavily dependent on, for example, big industry like automobiles or steel or rubber.
Right.
And all the plants shut down, it essentially becomes a ghost town. The entire city could grind to a halt, in effect, right? Because of all the other businesses like restaurants and stores are all dependent on those paychecks
being
spent there, right?
So it's a ripple effect.
Wow.
So you have and you also have even more immediately as Roosevelt is inaugurated, you have a rash of bank failures.
Oh, okay.
You have a run on the banks.
People want to go get that cash.
And it of course it escalates, right? Once you see there's a run on the bank, you don't want to be left holding the bag, so you run to the bank too.
There is no
federal deposit insurance. Mm-hmm. If a bank fails and you didn't get your money out, your money is gone for all time, and there's nothing you can do. And I've shown my students a video where a historian talks about this one story. There was a janitor who saved for his entire life, saved $1,000. That was his retirement nest egg. That was a lot more money then than it is now, by the way. He had $1,000 in the Bank of the United States. He was retired. And so the bank failed, and he spent several days camped outside the bank, sort of banging on the door.
Mm-hmm.
It was shuttered. The bank had failed. It was shuttered. It was not going to reopen. It finally dawned on him he was never going to get his money back, so he went back to his basement apartment and he hanged himself. And that is not an isolated incident. And that's how, as the historian in the video points out, that's how the Depression crushed people. Right.
Okay.
You know, he had no. There is no safety net apart from that. There's no Social Security. There's no disability. There's no workers' comp. There's no unemployment insurance of any kind. There's nothing like that. That's your nest egg, and if your nest egg is in the bank, and that bank folds, you are now destitute.
And it's not like he'd been improvident. He'd been saving.
Exactly. And that's really the important point. He had done everything he was supposed to. He had been prudent. He had saved for his retirement in the absence of any sort of external structure to encourage. Or to prop that up.
Right.
He did the right thing and he was destroyed.
Yeah.
And that sort of personalizes how what's going on with millions and millions of Americans. In any case, Franklin Roosevelt, the good news is you've been elected president.
Yeah.
The bad news is this is the situation you walk into. He gives his famous inaugural address where he says the only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
Right.
But the first thing he does is he declares what is euphemistically referred to as a bank holiday.
Okay, now we often hear about this, and certainly in Europe they have bank holidays as a regular holiday, but what does it mean in
this
American
is different.
History?
This is not really a holiday in that sense.
No,
this
okay.
means to prevent the complete collapse of the banking system.
Okay.
He orders all the banks shut down, basically to interrupt the run on the banks.
Oh, a temporary closing the doors.
So that people can't get their money out anymore.
Okay.
And that buys him a little bit of time
to
stabilize the bank system. For example, sending out, and I've actually seen footage of this, they send out pallets of cash to these banks. He does other things, which I'm not an expert on, but he basically, it buys him a few days to stabilize the banking system. And that's when he then, March 12th, 1933, he gives the first of his so-called fireside chats.
Okay, March 12th, 1933. This is only, what, a week after he's inaugurated?
He's been president for 8 days.
Wow. So this is a really quick 1-2 punch in a good sense. There's the bank holiday, sending out all the cash, and then there's the fireside chat.
Right.
Did they announce that the president's – I mean, they must have announced he's going to go on the radio, fireside.
Right. But then I think the actual introduction was very spare and bare bones. It was essentially – I mean, this is a rough quote. It's something like, ladies and gentlemen, the president of the United States.
Oh, it's not like it was – it was advertised beforehand.
No, there was no like strike up the band or whatever. No, I think it was very low key, very spare, very no nonsense. And also keep in mind, this already you're getting a sense of Roosevelt's political skill.
Okay. Because
he doesn't just do these things
to
fix the banking system and to sort of try and lead to recovery and reform, etc. He obviously feels that the usual modes of communication are not enough. People need to be reassured. They need to know that someone is sort of on it, that someone is working the problem.
Oh, okay, okay.
I think intuitively he sensed that there had been this gap, there had been this sort of void in the White House in terms of communication.
Right.
And by the way, Hoover's not an evil man. It's not like he wasn't concerned.
No.
He was just not up to the task, and certainly his philosophy was not up to the task. And Roosevelt realized that you need to reach out to people and you need to connect with them and use, by the way, this new, relatively new technology in a relatively new way. We'll get to that more in a minute, sort of the context of people using it. But everyone either has one of these or is aware of this. This is the new way I can reach into people's homes apart from, you know, speeches and newspapers and newsreels.
Okay, so what's the topic of what he's going to talk about on – we're going to listen to a clip in a second, Buzzkillers, but what does he talk – does he talk about the bank holiday?
Yes, he does. Okay. Yes. You know, and I think he's trying to do two things. One is to sort of broadly reassure people about, yes, the economy is horrible, but we're doing things to fix it.
Yeah.
And then he talks more narrowly about the banking crisis and what he's doing to fix that.
Okay. All right. Well, here we have it. Here we have President Roosevelt speaking in his first fireside chat. Now, of course, he didn't call it fireside chats, right off the top of the bat, anyway.
Right.
On March 12th, 1933.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
My friends, I want to talk for a few minutes with the people of the United States about banking. To talk with the comparatively few who understand the mechanics of banking, but more particularly with the overwhelming majority of you who use banks for the making of deposits and the drawing of checks. I want to tell you what has been done in the last few days and why it was done and what the next steps are going to be. I recognize that the many proclamations from state capitals and from Washington, the legislation, the treasury regulations, and so forth, couched for the most part in banking and legal terms, ought to be explained for the benefit of the average citizen. I owe this in particular because of the fortitude and the good temper with which everybody has accepted the inconvenience and the hardships of the banking holiday. And I know that when you understand what we in Washington have been about, I shall continue to have your cooperation as fully as I have had your sympathy and your help during the past week. First of all, let me state the simple fact that when you deposit money in a bank, the bank does not put the money into a safe deposit vault. It invests your money in many different forms of credit, in bonds, in commercial paper, in mortgages, and in many other kinds of loans. In other words, the bank puts your money to work to keep the wheels of industry and of agriculture turning round. A comparatively small part of the money that you put into the bank is kept in currency, an amount which in normal times is wholly sufficient to cover the cash needs of the average citizen. In other words, the total amount of all the currency in the country is only a comparatively small proportion of the total deposits in all the banks of the country. What then happened during the last few days of February and the first few days of March? Because of undermined confidence on the part of the public, there was a general rush by a large portion of our population to turn bank deposits into currency or gold. A rush so great that the soundest banks couldn't get enough currency to meet the demand.
Okay, we're back. We noticed that President Roosevelt did not have sponsors for his fireside chats. He didn't.
I know that's the real tragedy here. Yeah.
Think of all the razors that they could sell, or all the other podcast advertisers who could have benefited from being on the fireside chats. So what happens? Presumably, because it's a first time thing, lots of people listen to it.
Right.
And what's the immediate effect?
And I have not systematically studied all these, but I'm pretty sure this was one of the chats that had the greatest immediate impact and was intended to.
Sure.
What happens is it's
kind of an emergency statement.
It is an emergency statement, and obviously makes a huge splash, and a lot of people tune in. And if you obviously causation cannot 100% be established, but it's pretty clear by people's behavior that he had some effect, because what happens when the banks reopen a few days later, deposits far outstrip withdrawals.
Oh, wow. There's a run on a bank to take out money just a week before, and now there's a run on the bank to deposit money back in.
Yes.
That's reestablishing confidence.
Right. Pretty much. And I've seen another stat which basically says that half of the money that had been hoarded was redeposited.
Wow.
So obviously he's done at least something to reestablish confidence in the banking system after that. And by the way, there's also a little uptick in the stock market at the same time, which is also not surprising. Obviously, the stock market does not recover from 1929 levels to 1929 levels for quite some time. That's going to happen years later. But if I may, let me quote from one listener who wrote to the president the next day. And by the way, just parenthetically, one of the reasons why we have a sense of connection as historians between the public and Roosevelt is the, I believe it's millions of letters that went to the White House over the course of the Roosevelt administration.
Oh, literally millions.
I think I'm pretty sure it's millions. Remember, he was also president for 12 years.
True.
But one of the ways we get a sense of what everyday people were experiencing in the Great Depression is they wrote to the president. And some of these letters, you can find a lot of these online. Some of the letters are amazing, but it's because it's so intimate. It's like, for example, we're destitute. My daughter needs a new pair of shoes. Mr. President, can you send me a few dollars so I can buy my daughter some shoes?
Wow.
You know, which we look back and it's like sort of absurd and pathetic, but amazing that they would even occur to them. Wow, I'm so – I mean, who can I turn to? Well, I can turn to the president or alternatively the first lady, Eleanor Roosevelt.
Oh, yes, of course.
Also had a very close connection with people. She had a daily newspaper column called My Day. She was also on radio a lot, and there was also people that sort of adored her and would write her a lot of letters asking – often asking – in other words, not just you're doing a great job, but can you help me personally?
Wow.
So – in any case, here's one listener who listened to that first fireside chat on March 12, 1933, and then wrote to the White House. I'm quoting, I feel that he walked into my home, sat down, and in plain and forceful language explained to me how he was tackling the job I and my fellow citizens gave him. I thought what splendid thing it would be if he could find time to do that occasionally. Needless to say, such forceful, direct, and honest action commands the respect of all Americans. It is certainly deserving of it. My humble and sincere gratitude to a great leader. May God protect him. In other words, it was sent to the White House, but he was talking to the secretary at the White House.
Oh, sure.
That's the third person thing.
And I think it's interesting what you said, that one of the effects of the fireside chats on people was that they knew that the president was on it. And that this person sort of implies that they're saying, me to know he was tackling the job.
Right.
You know, that, you know.
And I'm going to assume that that's a person who didn't feel like they were getting that from 4 years of Herbert Hoover.
Sure, or Coolidge.
So, and that's important to keep in mind. FDR is in some ways properly set up for this because of his predecessor, because the contrast the contrast is going to be so great by comparison. There was also I was amused to find this one anecdote. It's just an anecdote. Apparently, there was a group of people somewhere on the East Coast listening to the fireside chat, and afterwards they spontaneously broke out into singing the song "Happy Days Are Here Again." Which I'm pretty sure was the official or semi-official song of the FDR campaign in 1932.
Yes, I'm sure that's true.
But this is almost a level of credulity, or for lack of a better word, hokiness, that some of us would sort of recoil from today.
But you mean it's ripe for buzz killing?
Kind of. But the idea that people would be so enthusiastic after listening to their president in any context – just break out into song like that?
Well, you know, actually, Lady Buzzkill and I were talking about how when we were young, you know, and we would be at various – young as kids, various parties. We the Duke and Duchess would throw a party. And the older people sometimes would, you know, were sitting around and just talk
– sure.
Break into a Sinatra song for fun.
Right.
And one of her most famous quotes, Lady Buzzkill's most famous quotes lately these days is, why don't people just break out into song for fun? And I said, well, they do at, you know, monster truck rallies and stuff that we don't go to.
Or they do, and then they're committed.
Yeah.
Right. And also, I would say, and this maybe this is a bit of a stretch, but among the older generation, who maybe had memories of or had, you know, had older relatives from the pre-radio period, keep in mind that before radio and before the phonograph, if you wanted to listen to music, you produced it yourself.
That's right. That's
and
right.
And that's why sheet music was so huge, and having, you know, the big turning point in your sort of affluence was when you could acquire the piano for the house.
Yeah, and everyone who had a piano had a daughter or son who one of them learned how to play it, so
right.
there could be entertainment.
Right, and so and that's another I think another part of the context for breaking out into song. but this is then immediately followed by the New Deal and this sort of rash of legislation trying to – keep in mind you had huge Democratic majorities in the House and Senate, very, very okay. willing, eager to work with the president. People should read about this period. It's amazing. Congress is voting on laws that haven't even been typeset yet.
You're kidding.
They're just – literally the sort of sheafs of paper – in the sponsor's hand, and it's basically saying, well, here's what's in this bill, kind of, I think. All those in favor? I mean, it's that much of a rush job.
Wow.
In this so-called first 100 days. And by the way, that's where that measuring stick entirely arbitrary comes from.
Oh, okay. Because we say it all the time now.
Not too long from now, we're going to be talking about Donald Trump's first 100 days.
Right.
It's entirely arbitrary, but it comes from this period, the so-called 100 days, first 100 days of FDR's presidency, 1933, when there is this amazing flurry of new legislation. And it reflects Roosevelt's philosophy. Just like throw everything in the wall, see what sticks, see what works. Some of it doesn't work, some of it does.
But it also that sort of reinforces the idea, probably in the public mind, that again, FDR is
exactly.
on it. So he's yes. on it in the sense that lots of legislation is being put through. But he's also telling people, implying or indirectly telling people right. through the fireside chats that he's on it.
Right. And I've seen interviews with people live through the Depression, and they talk about this period, and they're like, somebody's finally doing something.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're
right,
not
yeah.
and they're not even entirely interested in or aware of what they're doing, but there is this impression of furious activity, and that itself has sort of a lifting effect on the morale of people.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Right. So and this is where in the New Deal and in the years to come, this is where a lot of the pieces of essentially the modern American welfare state are put into place. Things like Social Security,
sure.
Aid to family with dependent children, you know, regulation of the stock market and the banking system, farm price supports, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. A lot of these things which we take for granted today, which are created in this period. Maybe next time we could talk a little bit about the fireside chats in general. Obviously, we don't
right,
have time
yeah.
to talk about all of them, but people should know some of the basic facts about them.
Right.
He gave these chats throughout his presidency.
Oh, so they're not just in the first – it's
no.
not in the first 100 days
no,
of the
no,
first
no,
no, term.
No, no, no,
okay.
In fact, they're,
okay.
if you look, they're pretty evenly distributed.
Oh.
FDR – they're also – they're a lot less common than I thought they were. I thought they were more. And that's partly because he put a lot of work into them. Typically, a fireside chat went through 12 drafts.
Oh, that's amazing, because they sound like they're almost conversational. They don't need drafts, but apparently
yeah, that's,
they do. Okay.
It's studied casualness.
Well, I can assure the Buzzkillers that our blog posts don't go through 12 drafts.
What? Are you yeah. kidding? Yeah, 12 drafts. Partly one of the reasons Roosevelt thinks these are so important is because major newspapers at the time were typically in the hands of his opponents.
Oh, that's right.
Some worse than others,
yeah.
but a lot of newspaper editors and publishers were very conservative, opponents of Roosevelt, opponents of the New Deal. And so that's – by the way, he might have done these anyway, but it's an mm-hmm. additional incentive for him to sort of circumvent the newspapers.
But the newspapers are still so important because radio is still kind of new.
Oh, yeah. Well, newspapers were much, much more important than – a lot more people read them.
Yeah.
Big cities had multiple newspapers. Individual newspapers had morning and afternoon editions. If people have the determination, they should go look at a copy of the New York Times from the 30s or 40s or 50s when it truly was the newspaper of record, and they tried to record or sort of document everything that went on. The front section of New York Times, much bigger than today's in terms of its dimensions.
That's amazing.
Could run to 70, 80, 90 pages.
That's amazing.
A daily.
Yeah. Yeah.
it's pretty insane to consider what happens these days. But in any case, so Roosevelt feels like he has to go around these editors.
Go over their heads by going directly to the
exactly
people.
Right. Sort of an end around. In terms of their format, he deliberately kept the chats extremely simple.
Yep, yep.
People have studied them, and they've discovered that 80% of the words in the chats were among the most the 1,000 most common words used at the time.
Okay, so this is a linguistic analysis saying that 80% of the time, basically, he's using his everyday speech.
So in other words, even someone who is only marginally literate, and by the way, there were, especially in the rural areas, there were lots of marginally literate people in this time period.
Okay, and he's not using complicated banking terms or financial terms like fiduciary and stuff
right,
like
exactly.
That.
Yeah. And even that, he's. I mean, I'll give you this example in a second here, but he's going from simple to super simple.
Okay,
because there's this account from his Secretary of Labor, Frances Perkins. Roosevelt asked her at one point to help him with a fireside chat on Social Security. This is from Perkins' account. Quote: "I summed up one section by saying we are trying to construct a more inclusive society. I heard, this is Perkins speaking, yeah. I heard that speech over the radio some weeks later, and this is how he, with his instinct for simplicity, wound up that section. Quote, we are going to make a country in which no one is left out.
That's so much better than inclusive society.
You know, and you know, people like us, I hear a word like inclusive, and I'm like, well, that's not a big word.
No.
It is when you have a vocabulary of just a few thousand words.
Sure, sure.
And Roosevelt understands that. Roosevelt, by the way, a member of the elite. Product of an
elite.
The super elite. He's a product of Harvard University. He has the vocabulary, but he just chooses not to use it because he's clever that way. He also does other technical things. He speaks very, very slowly. The people have studied these much more carefully than I would ever care to. But they find
radio
that,
history nerds.
Exactly. For radio history geeks out there, he spoke typically in these fireside chats at a rate of 100 to 120 words per minute, which turns out to be 30% slower than most radio broadcasts at the time.
Okay, wow.
And one of the most famous, a huge celebrity in the radio world in this period was a fellow by the name of Walter Winchell,
right?
Who even though later on he's going to be a major force behind the McCarthyite witch hunts and very tight with J. Edgar Hoover. In this period, he's actually pro FDR. But my point here is that he typically spoke at 200 words a minute.
Oh, and he's very, very popular.
Yes, very, very popular and known for his sort of machine gun delivery on radio. He's speaking at basically twice the pace of FDR. And this is a deliberate decision on FDR's part, right? He wants to make sure that he is heard. He uses simple words, goes very slowly. On some grave occasions like the immediate post-Pearl Harbor fireside chat, December 9th, 1941, FDR slowed down to 88 words per minute.
Oh, so that's like a funeral or
yeah, exactly. Speech, right? Which strikes me as a pace where in any other context people would say, "Oh, would you change the channel?"
Yeah, or I mean, to the point.
Exactly. Come on, speed it up. But at that, apparently, it was perfect for that. 88 words a minute, extremely slow, a lot slower than I'm speaking now, for example.
The fact that he's paying attention to that, and you know, he isn't farming out this stuff to voice experts and communications experts are saying, okay, now we can't go faster than this. He actually seems to have figured it out himself.
Yeah, exactly right. And that's very, very important. From what I could tell, a lot of this is his assistants are happy just to sort of do it. And he's the one insisting, no, we have to do it this way. Or no, let's adjust it in this sense. And so he even pays attention to like some of the early, they discover early on that because of his teeth, he had an audible whistle.
What is a sort of vocal? Whatever, not, just sounded like that.
Yeah, not a dog whistle. But.
Yeah, he didn't break into song halfway through.
No, I don't think he could. I don't think he could modulate his whistle.
So he had a little.
Yes, exactly right.
As he was talking normally.
Right, and so then he had dental work done to fix it.
Wait! You're saying the president of the United States had dental work done to fix a slight whistle in his voice?
So
for
that,
the radio?
So that he sounded better on radio. So this is a level of attention to detail in sort of marketing or public relations that I think we would normally associate with our age.
Yeah, he went under the knife in order to fix it. Wow, that is amazing.
I'm assuming he had a good dentist.
Yes. Probably someone he knew at Harvard.
Probably a Harvard-educated dentist.
Yes. Wow.
In any case, he also was clever enough to deliberately keep them rare. Here are the stats. He only gave a total of 30 fireside chats in his entire presidency, which lasted over 4,400 days, right? He is elected, let's keep in mind, he's elected president four times. In fact, that was made illegal because of him.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
That was the Republican Party's going away present to the dead FDR, was we're never going to have four-term presidents again.
Yeah. Well, he's... Constitutional amendments.
Exactly.
A big
deal. They that was all fair and square. They amended the Constitution. In any case, so 30 fireside chats total. That averages out to about 2.5 a year.
Wow, that's nothing compared to the weekly radio address the president does now.
Yeah.
The presidents have done.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, exactly. Every Saturday, the presidents still give the Saturday addresses.
And almost nobody sits around the fireside to listen to them.
Not so much. There were never more than four in a single year. And then the question is, well, why? It's not entirely a deliberate decision. It's partly because these did take a long time to prepare, right? If you have to go through 12 drafts on each one, I wouldn't want to do more than a few a year.
It's not like he didn't have other things to do.
Exactly. He did kind of have some other duties. But he also worried that if they became too common, they would lose their effectiveness. That strikes me as a pretty sound instinct. He said at one point, quote, "We must avoid too much personal leadership. My good friend Winston Churchill has suffered a little from this."
Yeah, we forget that there were a lot of people in Britain and even in the United States and in Europe who complained that Churchill was trying to be too much of a personality prime minister.
That's right.
And, you know, tone it down, Winnie, and get back to work was a very common attitude.
Mm-hmm. Right. A little too visible. So he recognizes that. And so the last fireside chat is given on June 12th, 1944, in association with the war loan drive. That's just a few days after D-Day. So he's giving them before and during World War II. The only other notable one I want to talk about here is a very famous one from February 23rd, 1942, when he gives a fireside chat to explain the early post-Pearl Harbor defeats that the United States is suffering in the Pacific.
Okay.
Let's keep in mind that, you know, he does give that one right after Pearl Harbor. But after Pearl Harbor, which of course is bad news in its own right, is followed by a string of defeats in the Philippines and at Guam and Wake Island and a lot of other places. And it seems like all the news is bad, so he feels the need to go on the air and sort of inspire people, inform them about the long slog ahead, etc., and to educate the public. And the announcement beforehand basically says that the president would like you to get a map or an atlas so you can follow along. And I keep in mind, this is radio. It's purely audio.
Yeah, yeah.
But this is sort of an early attempt at sort of multimedia.
And interactive.
Right,
yeah.
Because obviously he can't just describe over the radio points on the map and hope that all the Americans who then as now are often hard of geography.
Yeah.
He can't just sort of assume that they know where everything is.
Right.
So he says, go out and get an atlas and a map. And then you can follow along when I'm describing sort of the course of the war and some of the strategy and some of the distances involved, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so there is not a run on the banks. There's a run on the bookstores and the map stores. And there are all across the country, there are places that run out. They sell out of atlases. They sell out of world maps. Partly because I'm assuming there wasn't much demand before. Selling out of these things is probably not a stretch. But it also shows you that the response, people are going to tune in and they want to be able to follow along. They don't want to be left out. So they go out and buy maps and books. So atlases by the hundreds of thousands.
Yeah, but there also seems to be a little genius here. And I'm speculating, Buzzkiller, so let's not turn this into another myth. But – you know, when you ask people to get a map out and you're talking about, as you say, the distances involved, and they see that the Philippines is halfway around the world, and there must have been some in the back of people's minds going, well, no wonder we're losing a little bit. This must be extremely hard to do.
Right.
You know, logistically. I'm sure people didn't think logistically, but you know what I mean.
Right. And also things like, I mean, look how much ocean we still have left to protect us, even though this island has fallen or Japanese are doing here, right? But also, and then on the flip side, you know, to reconquer the Pacific, that's going to take some time and effort, right? We're going to have to gear up. It's going to be a long slog, right? There's going to be no lightning strike that ends the war very quickly.
So any sort of knee-jerk opposition to the early war effort was probably reduced by the fact that people got a sort of realist thing, you know, in your face.
Right. At least at the margins, analysis. I'm sure it helped, right? Yeah. And he also understands that right? As we would say today, people need buy-in, right? People need to feel like they're part of the struggle. They have to be encouraged to either join in the military and fight hard, or work for industry, or work for a war bond drive or a scrap drive, or you know, do the right thing on the home front, like don't engage in black marketeering, even though a quarter of Americans are going to do that anyway. You know, in other words, do their part, and people will do their part if they understand the stakes and if they understand what's involved. And he understands that, and so he reaches out.
Yeah, so it's the voice and the having the maps and the
right. Wow. And so we have some idea about the audience that he reached.
Yeah.
Before the war, it seems, the stat I've seen is before the war, about 18% of the radio audience listened in typically.
To the fireside chats.
To the fireside chats.
Oh, so it's not as if everybody sat down in 1933 when the first one came out.
No, not as far as I know. I mean, that first one, I don't have the figures for that, but I'm sure those were higher than average.
Right.
But then the listenership goes way up in wartime, and not surprisingly. Sure. You have millions of people in uniform. People want to know what's going on with their son, right? Or is the country under threat of invasion, et cetera. So the audience in wartime went up to 58%.
Okay.
Another way of measuring it, there were several fireside chats where over 60 million people listened to them.
Wow.
So in other words, that 18% figure, that's an average. I'm assuming you had some which are much higher and some much lower. 83% of radio owners tuned in on the December 9th, 1941 and the February 23rd, 1942 fireside chats. 83% of radio owners.
That's amazing.
That is just – yeah. I mean, that's astonishing.
Now, and also –
any way you slice it.
I mean, you know, we need to remind ourselves and remind the Buzzkillers that, you know, it's not as if you miss the airing, you can record it, or you can hear it, or you can download it later, or anything like that.
Right.
This is those days when you had to be there when it was happening.
Right. And it is – the early days of radio are – or not just the early days, but the heyday of radio is much like the early days of television, where it alters people's behavior, because you will do anything to avoid missing your favorite show.
Right.
So in the early age of television, you know, the water officials around the United States discover these odd spikes of water consumption during prime time. And it's because the entire city is going to the bathroom at the same time. Because they're all watching during commercials, because they're all watching the same TV show. Well, there was a similar thing with radio, you know, things like The Shadow, or you know, some of these gangster shows, right? Man, by the way, early radio had the full gamut. It had sports, it had music, it had entertainment, it had dramas and serials. And so people were hooked. Mm-hmm. And so that's sort of the groundwork, or sort of the foundation that FDR can then build on with his fireside chats.
Oh, I see. So it's not as if he's inventing the radio audience in addition to inventing the fireside
chats. No, he is tapping into it.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
And so now I guess finally maybe we can get to some of the myths.
Mm. I don't know. I'm loving the sort of excitement of this new meaty thing. And of course, I'm remembering that, you know, you and I remember that when VCRs came out, that was a big deal.
Oh, yeah.
And before that, if you didn't see, you know, All in the Family on whatever, you didn't see it.
Right. Or you just prayed to be watching later on in some other channel when you saw the rerun.
Yeah. Right.
That was about the best you could do. Yeah. But exactly. If you don't tune in, it's all live. If you don't tune in, miss it.
Yeah.
So one of the myths. You know, and obviously this would only be a myth among fireside chat geeks or people who had at least thought about this problem. And it is true, even among historians, was certainly true with me before I sort of did this preparation. I think a lot of people end up giving Roosevelt too much credit for the fireside chats as a complete break with the past.
Oh, okay.
As a completely new
innovation.
That's
what I would have thought, yeah.
Right. There is an article out there by a historian by the name of Joy Hayes.
Yeah,
that I'm familiar with, and she makes, I think, some very good and convincing points. She says that in the reality, as opposed to the myth, is that there were some important influences creating an environment in which Roosevelt was acting and choosing to use the radio. One is commercial radio.
Okay.
That was already obviously existed for years, and Roosevelt is aware of some of its methods and some of its successes and pitfalls.
And of course, in commercial radio, there are stats for advertising and listenership.
Exactly right.
So it's not as if they're doing this in the dark.
Right. So that's, you know, and that may be kind of an obvious point, but you know, it's not like
not obvious in 1928, right? 29, 30,
right, like that. And it's you know, it's not like Roosevelt is, hey, what's this gadget? It's a radio. I'll use it for the presidency. It's not. It's not like that. Secondly, his predecessor in New York, in fact, in the governor's mansion in New York, a fellow by the name of Al Smith, the one who was really badly beaten in the presidential election of 1928. he was an ally of FDR's at one point, and then later on became a rival of FDR's. He also used radio.
Oh, okay.
When he was in office, I'm assuming not nearly as successfully as Roosevelt did, but
sure.
there were pre-Roosevelt examples of politicians using or trying to use the radio.
And as a governor, but still an executive.
As a governor, right.
Of the biggest state at that time.
You have a huge and influential state, absolutely right. And then thirdly, and in a similar vein, there is Herbert Hoover himself.
Herbert Hoover
also used radio. There is also, I've seen at least one case where it's audiovisual, where in other words, he's addressing the people on camera.
Holy cow.
And pretty sure that footage still exists out there somewhere. Okay. And by the way, if that doesn't sound like a big deal, remember 1927 is when we have our first talkie.
Yeah.
The jazz singer. So the idea that you can watch a motion picture and hear the person speaking who you see on the screen, that's pretty new.
Yeah.
You and I take it for granted, but it's a pretty big deal. If you've ever seen a silent movie, it's really disconcerting to try and follow a movie where you have all this action and then a few words on the screen and then all this action. It's a very different and, I would argue, much inferior experience to watching a real movie.
This is so fascinating because we talk about FDR being a complete break from Hoover. We talk about FDR innovating so many things that Hoover not only didn't do but couldn't conceive of, but it turns out that these things, you know, it isn't a complete turning of the page or an opening of a new book.
Yes, and by the way, like just sort of if you look at presidential history, that is the case more often than not. Presidents, in other words, especially when you switch parties, presidents are at pains to distance themselves and say, look, I'm entirely new.
Sure, sure.
You start looking at the history, more often than not, there's actually a lot of continuity there, including, by the way, in this case, when it comes to policy. Some of the things like the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, reluctantly signed into law by Herbert Hoover in early 1932, actually points the way to the New Deal.
Okay.
So the idea that Hoover is sort of this backward, Gilded Age-style Republican do-nothing is really unfair and really a myth on its own.
Okay, well, I can tell we are going to have a Hoover
show. We may have to do a Hoover show.
You know, if
give
I had
his
been,
props.
If Alex Trebek had woken me up in the middle of the night and said, okay, Professor, who passed the Reconstruction Finance Corporation bill, blah, blah, blah,
right.
I would have automatically said FDR.
Yeah.
But it's actually Hoover.
Right.
Okay, well, there you go.
Right. So he is not nearly the knuckle-dragger I think he is often portrayed as.
Right.
And by the way, maybe we can talk about this in the Hoover show, but he was so deeply unpopular when he left office. When he went to vote on Election Day 1932 in downtown San Francisco, he was pelted with stink bombs.
Oh, gosh.
That is not exactly rolling out the red carpet for the president. In any case, so he in some ways he got a bum rap. But it also turns out that even though, of course, that he did try to use radio and, by the way, did try to use radio to communicate more directly with the American people – The truth that remains is that he just wasn't very good at it.
Oh, okay. In fact, it's not just that people might not have liked his policies or he got blamed for the depression. He wasn't a good radio voice.
Yes, and I will let people listen for themselves. The proof is in the pudding.
Okay, well, here we go. Here's an example of Herbert Hoover on the radio, a pre-fireside chat, fireside chat.
My fellow citizens, this broadcast tonight marks the beginning of the mobilization of the whole nation for a great undertaking to provide security for those of our citizens and their families who, through no fault of their own, face unemployment and privation during the coming winter. As an important part of our plans for national unity of action in this emergency, I have created a great national organization under the leadership of Mr. Walter Gifford, to cooperate with the governors, the state, and the local agencies, and with the many national organizations of business, of labor, and of welfare, with the churches, and our fraternal and patriotic societies, so that the countless streams of human helpfulness which have been the mainstay of our country in all emergencies may be directed wisely and effectively.
Wow, you're right, Professor. That's not exactly melodious tones.
No,
convincing.
No. In fact, I mean, I would argue he sort of makes Ben Stein sound like Martin Luther King Jr. when it comes to sort of ability to speak on radio.
Right.
Yeah, it's kind of sad. Yeah, and keep in mind here that it's not just about tone and style and delivery. Part of the problem here is more substantive. In other words, even if he had a better style and tone, part of the problem is, like I said before, he has this small government philosophy. And if you look at some of Hoover's public announcements about the Depression, his argument essentially is you all need to work together to get through this.
Oh,
and
okay.
And what's left unspoken, or I don't know, maybe he did actually say this, but sort of parenthetically, the federal government is not going to do anything to help you.
Right, because among other things, he thinks the federal government make it worse.
Right, they make it, and it's not the proper role of federal government. And so basically he's saying you all need to sort of buck up and work together and ride this out.
Okay.
And so in the context of his philosophy, that's the logical thing to say. But it pales in comparison to FDR, who then comes along and basically says, we are all in this together, you and you and you, and also me and the federal government together.
Okay. So
we all will pull together, and your federal government is there to help you. And here's what I'm going to do to help as the head of the federal government. And that even if that doesn't work out on the ground, which it often doesn't, the New Deal has a real mixed record of success when it comes to individual programs. Once again, he has connected with people because it's not just tone and style and delivery. It's also, wow, he gets the situation I'm in, and he's going to use the power of the government, which is growing, to help me.
Okay.
That is night and day in terms of the actual substance of the message that these two men are delivering via radio.
Okay. So it's not just the idea that FDR has – the calming tone of voice and everyone sits down by the fireside. People are actually paying attention to content.
Right. Or I'd put it another way. Let's say Roosevelt is delivering what is essentially Hoover's message.
Yeah.
Over time, I think people would have noticed and his popularity would have started to go down.
Holy cow.
I think. That's once again, it's a supposition. But in other words, if you had this same message of, well, government has no role to play and I'm really inspirational, but I'm trying to inspire you to all help each other because you're on your own, if that message would eventually also fall flat.
Wow. So it's not just perception.
It's a combination of the contents and the package.
Okay. Well, let's talk more about that, especially the impact of that content and the packaging. After we get back from our advertising department, who's going to give us a good explanation of how FDR used Harry's razors in the best possible way to help bring the country out of the Depression. Okay, we're going to take a little break from the discussion of the fireside chats, but not much of a break, because one of the reasons why FDR was able to address the nation so confidently, so clearly, and so convincingly was that he was a fan of Harry's razors. You know how happy we are here at the Institute that we're sponsored by Harry's Razors. We're sponsored by Harry's Razors because they've seen that for centuries, rip-off razor companies have been charging us a fortune for their blades. They make a tiny little change and then jack up their already high prices. You have to go to the drugstore and ask the local teenager to open the Fort Knox case to get the razors out. And then you get ripped off by the time you get to the register. Harry's doesn't do that. I love Harry's razors. Everyone who's used them at the Institute, everyone in the large extended Buzzkill family and Buzzkill Empire uses them. Their five-blade razors got a soft flex hinge for more comfortable glide. The trimmer blade is unbeatable. The lubricating strip makes everything even better. And of course, it has a texture handle for more control when it's wet. I shave in the shower, like so many Buzzkillers, and that makes a big difference. And then you do all of this, at still $2 a blade. What do you pay for the other rip-off razor companies that have been fleecing us for centuries? $4 or more you have to pay at the drugstore. And, of course, you got to get the local idiot, right, to come and open the Fort Knox case with 50 keys, and then you walk to the cashier and the price has gone up just by the time it takes to walk up to the front. Harry's isn't like that. They own the factory in Germany where they make the blades. They make the highest quality razor blades themselves, sell them online for half the price of the rip-off razor companies that sell them directly to you. You become a Harry's member just in the same way as you're a Buzzkiller. And they have a special offer for Buzzkillers. They'll send you their popular trial set for free, when you go to harrys.com. The free trial set has the razor, five-blade cartridge, and shaving gel, and you just pay a little bit for shipping. $3, I think it is. Plus, just for the Buzzkillers. Because you're Buzzkillers, you enter the code BUZZKILL, B-U-Z-Z-K-I-L-L, at checkout, and they'll give you their post-shave balm for free. You've heard me crow about the wonders of the post-shave balm for months now. It's fantastic. You'll look better, and your face will feel better all day when you use it. Of course, your Harry subscription plan is customizable in terms of shipping frequency, and you can cancel anytime. Let me repeat all that, Buzzkillers. Harrys.com, enter the code BUZZKILL at checkout. Your face will thank you, you'll look better, and your bank account will be a lot healthier. And now back to the Fireside Chats. Well, I think there's no mistaking, Professor, how clean-shaven FDR was. So he must have been, as we say, a fantastic Harry's customer.
Yep.
Yeah, so of course they
could... Dapper Frank, I think is what we should call him.
They couldn't see him on the radio, but they could hear him, and they could hear how clean-shaven he was. So that must have been some kind of impact.
Especially once he fixed that whistle in his...
Yeah, that's right. So let's talk about the other possible miss about the impact of the Fireside Chats.
I would say this is a possible myth, partly because we cannot, even with the data we have, we cannot accurately measure the quote-unquote impact.
Sure. It's a little bit of a psychohistory problem.
Right, exactly. And we don't have, you'd have to have sort of before and after interviews with a huge sample of people.
Yeah.
There's reason to believe among the people who have studied this that Fireside Chats and other types of use of media by presidents are not terribly good at persuasion.
Oh.
In other words, changing somebody's mind.
Yeah.
There's not so much evidence that that's going on. And I was reading something about the bully pulpit myth in general, that not just FDR, but a lot of presidents, a pretty convincing argument, this one article made, that not a lot of presidents have huge success of using the bully pulpit to change people's minds or to move a huge chunk of opinion by using the so-called bully pulpit.
And of course, that's a Theodore Roosevelt construction.
Right, exactly. And also a lot of presidents will say, well, that's one of the tools I have is I have my bully pulpit, right?
I
have
a microphone. Over the heads of Congress and over the heads of the newspapers.
And, if you look at someone like Woodrow Wilson, he tries that and fails when it comes to the League of Nations and things like that. I would just put it this way. People should be skeptical of claims about the ability of presidents to sway huge chunks of the public by using the bully pulpit.
And presumably we should be skeptical about it all the time now and
absolutely.
In the future just because, okay
exactly
an absolutely new way of thinking about it.
And more specifically with FDR, I think this is an important way of thinking about it. There's sort of a causation problem. For example, are people – is Roosevelt popular because people listen to him?
Uh-huh.
Or do people listen to him because he's popular?
I mean, all right.
In other words, I'm going to listen to the president tonight. Why? Because I already think he's great, and I already voted for him.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, the true test by that measure, the true test would be, for example, people who voted for Hoover in 1932, but then listen to Roosevelt a few times, and then vote for Roosevelt in 1936.
And that'd be almost impossible to figure out.
Right. And you'd have to. I mean, for example, it's pretty clear. Roosevelt has one of the great blowout reelection victories of all time in 1936,
over Alf Landon.
We've
never had an Alf as president, by the way. I think
no Alf. No, in fact, we should have an Alf Landon show.
Yeah.
The fellow who took all of two states in 1936. Yeah. Ouch. Anyway.
Ouch, Landon.
Alf. Ouch, Landon. Yes. From Western PA, by the way.
Oh, okay.
I know I'm not supposed to give geographical clues.
They're dialing in their missile targeting sites for software now.
Damn it. Oh, hang up the phone. They're tracing us. So, yeah, Roosevelt is reelected so overwhelmingly not because of his Fireside Chats. In other words, it's his policies, the fact that a lot of the indicators are moving in the right direction, is things like Social Security and the Works Progress Administration. And things like that, and they're putting a lot of people back to work.
Okay.
That's why. But he also wins overwhelmingly in 1932. So presumably, first time. So presumably a lot of people who are listening are already Roosevelt fans.
Yeah.
So in other words, you shouldn't look to see, well, is he convincing people to switch sides? I would say more likely these are having the impact of intensifying the support he already enjoys.
Okay.
In other words, you're taking Roosevelt supporters and making them even more loyal or even more enthusiastic.
So he's energizing the base.
Energizing the base, in effect, as we would say today. And I think that explains a lot of the people who you know, wear the black armband when he dies and are seen in public yeah. openly weeping, or the people who have the framed oil portrait, or more mm-hmm. commonly the framed picture cut out from the newspaper, put next to the fireplace over the radio.
Oh, yeah.
And so, by the okay. way, they can look at his picture while they listen. Right. Those are people who are – a lot of them probably already Roosevelt fans.
Okay. Now, that is not in its – in itself and in its own way, that's not insignificant.
No.
But then it sort of puts the lie to the myth that he became more popular because
right.
of the
thing. It adds some gray areas and some context, as we usually do.
Right.
For example, I was very curious to know to learn that only 4 times did Roosevelt explicitly link a fireside chat to particular legislation.
Oh, that's not very many.
That's not very many.
I think he'd
right.
want to whip up people to get contact
right.
their congressman.
Okay. Right. I interpret that as him almost deciding, you know what, I'm not going to tie these. In other words, I'm not going to make these sort of crass appeals to, hey, call your congressperson to get this law passed. That they're much at a much more sort of general level.
Okay.
And in other words, that's not he doesn't understand them as part of the mechanics of getting bills passed. But he understands it as a much more sort of vague and foundational way to build a connection between the people and the president.
Okay, and presumably
and therefore support indirectly.
I mean, I think we can take from this that FDR doesn't think that if I tell the people about this legislation over the radio in a fireside chat, then the Republicans will be scared to death that we better not oppose this because FDR is now whipping up public support for
right.
House resolution, whatever,
right.
you know.
Right.
And that, you know, it's not as if the Republicans are cowering because there's suddenly this new media president.
Right. Yeah. No, I think this is much more about general public relations and a general effort to get popular support and to establish a connection, and not about the nitty gritty details of getting people to vote or to call their congressperson to get laws passed.
Right. Okay. And as you say other times and earlier on, it's not as if every president therefore has a fireside chat because it doesn't. It obviously
right.
works in this.
Well, yeah, and that's the other way to look at this too, is that the context you really have to keep in the forefront of your mind here.
Uh-huh.
He is president during two, I would argue that apart from the Civil War, which obviously deserves its own category, these are the two, back-to-back, the two worst calamities in American history, the Great Depression followed by World War II. He's president okay. during both of them. People feel more vulnerable and more threatened than usual. Another president, mm-hmm. even with his same political skills and his rhetorical skills, probably wouldn't have the same impact because they're not working in the context of these calamities where people
okay.
feel
yeah.
vulnerable,
yeah.
feel threatened, need to be reassured, need to feel like they are led. And
uh-huh.
so the idea that this immediacy, the idea that he comes into your living room, not obviously in body, but in spirit.
Sure.
The right the people sure. there's actually a book out there called The Roosevelt Presence. And I think that's a good way to sort of think about this, is that the president through the fireside chats has a presence in people's lives that you don't see elsewhere. And that happens because they need it, or they think they need it because of these hard times.
Oh, so it's almost as if the public is as responsible for the success of the fireside chats as the president.
I think that's a great way of putting it.
Huh.
Absolutely
and,
right.
And that's probably why, as we were talking about before we hit the record button, there's this statue, this display in the FDR Museum in D.C.
FDR Memorial.
Sorry.
Right.
Of a listener listening to his radio.
Right. Which, by the way, it's just my sense that among the other memorials, it gets little love. It's partly because it's location. It's sort of off to the side there at the end of the National Mall where mm-hmm. the Lincoln Memorial and the Korean War and the Vietnam War Memorial are. But if the listeners ever go to D.C., make sure you go to the FDR Memorial. It's a very different type of memorial.
Hmm.
It's, first of all, it's not gleaming white. It's mostly sandstone.
Yeah.
And also it's horizontal. It's not a tower or a wedding cake like the Lincoln Memorial is.
Sure,
it's horizontal, and you walk through it, and it takes you through the Depression and the war. They do a terrific job, yeah, and it makes a reference to the fireside chats.
Yeah, and that's one thing we really don't appreciate enough, I think, as Americans, the National Park Service and the people who construct those things. You really do
here,
put a lot of
here.
Thought.
Here, yep. Yeah, no, it's a terrific memorial.
So I think that's exactly what you're saying. It's a display about the personal relationship
right.
that they're trying to build.
Right, absolutely, yeah, and you know, like I said, it's not just the fireside chats; it's this whole this whole context of depression and war and the fact that he's president for 12 years.
Sure.
And whole, just like the depression itself, a whole generation of Americans sort of – he was always president.
Okay. And so yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And so when he dies in April 1945, a lot of Americans feel that loss, even people who didn't vote for him. Because it's obviously it's a huge turning point in their lives because he was always president.
Yeah.
And certainly among his supporters, they feel that because they feel like they knew him, quote unquote, and it's partly because of the fireside chats.
And also because, as you said earlier, Eleanor Roosevelt's does her column and is also sometimes on the radio.
Yeah, no, she was also a sort of a celebrity and a public phenomenon that it's hard to get our heads around.
Now, is one of the ways we know or historians can gauge this personal relationship because of these millions of letters, of one of the letters you quoted earlier?
Yes, and you know, keep in mind that in terms of the experiences of everyday Americans, we don't have great information, right? Your everyday people don't leave much of a paper trail.
No one sits down and says, oh gosh, my life is made.
Right, a lot of people don't keep diaries. People who do keep diaries, they're not made public. They're lost or they're kept or they're destroyed or whatever.
And they're not representative.
They're not donated to museums. They're not given – right, or they're not representative. Or a lot of people don't write letters or the letters – they don't talk about politics or the president or the letters don't get saved systematically. So particularly for the Great Depression and World War II, one of the unique sources – and by the way, there are edited collections of some of these. One of them, an excellent book called Down and Out in the Great Depression. Obviously it's a tiny, tiny sample.
Yeah, sure. Oh, yeah.
It's a representative sample. It's by a historian by the name of Robert McIlvaine, who's gone through these, and he groups them by topic, and it's a great way of finding out what everyday people went through in the Great Depression, and it's in the form of these letters that are written to the White House, and why are people burying their souls in letters to a stranger, i.e., Franklin or Eleanor Roosevelt? It's because they feel this connection. And so it's a windfall for historians. It's one of the great sort of windows into the experience of everyday Americans in the Great Depression.
One of the things I was thinking as we were planning this show and talking about doing a show on the Fireside Chats is that there must be a myth that they're overrated. But in a way, they're overrated historically in terms of impact on all the things we talked about or innovation. But they're also not overrated.
Right.
If you lump them in with all these other things that are going on that are new and innovative and impactful.
Right. Right. And also, you know, history is often not, you know, us nailing something 100%. It's our best guess. And our best, if you were making a best guess, why is he so popular? Why do people write him so many letters?
Yeah.
A sort of a pillar of our best guess is going to be the Fireside Chats. I think that's pretty clear.
A pillar of our best guess. That's a fantastic way. Well, it also explains to the buzzkillers that, you know, we tend to make these certain statements in the public about FDR did this and then it changed this and this caused this and it caused that.
Right.
And things are obviously so much more complicated.
And our evidence is imperfect.
Our evidence is imperfect. Yep. Well, there you have it, buzzkillers. Fireside chats are very, very important, but you can't reduce them to simple headlines and simple sound bites. Talk to you next week.